Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming out. So I am a literature scholar, and I think my paper maybe goes in a slightly different direction than some of the places we've been recently, but maybe that's okay. Change things up just a little bit. The title of my paper is What We Talk About When We Talk About Extinction, riffing very consciously on the Raymond Carver story. And I was, because of that, inspired to think a little bit more seriously about love, which is where this paper comes from. Poems about extinction are difficult to come by. Perhaps it's the abstractness of loss on a global scale, or the dearth of familiar figures for vanished species, or perhaps the trouble lies with form. The lyric mode unavoidably signals presence rather than absence, and also there is its inherent anthropocentrism. Other forms seem equally unsuitable, tainted by their association with truth or beauty or love. Imagine for a moment a sonnet sequence about extinction. What might such an unlikely expression of desire look like? What emotions would it aim to evoke? There are, of course, some poems that tackle extinction, including one I often teach titled The Big Picture by Ellen Bass. Written in first person, the poem opens with a folksy saying, "I try to look at the big picture," the speaker begins. She elaborates. "The sun, ardent tongue, licking us like a mother besotted with her new cub, will wear itself out. Everything is transitory." Turning from the distant future to the distant past, she ponders the Cretaceous Paleogene extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs, and quote, "Before that, the volcanoes of the Permian period, with its innumerable burnt ferns and reptiles, sharks and bony fish. That," she concludes, "was extinction on a scale that makes our losses look like a bad day at the slots." Still, the speaker cannot shake, quote, her longing for the last 600 Iberian lynx with their tufted ears and host of other imperiled species. I'll read from the poem. "Brazilian guitarfish, the 4% of them still cruising the seafloor, eyes staring straight up. And all the newborn marsupials, red kangaroos, joeys the size of honeybees, steelhead trout, river dolphins, so many species of frogs breathing through their damp, permeable membranes." On the bus, the speaker aches for a glimpse of cardinals in the snow and for, quote, "polar bears, the cream and amber of their fur." Once at home, her thoughts turn to a quotidian scene, sitting on the couch with her teenage son, watching, quote, "a cheap silver chain shimmer across his throat, rising and falling with his pulse." There never was anything else she uses, only these excruciatingly insignificant creatures we love. As the sketch of the poem suggests, the big picture rejects the big picture as a means of reframing. Deep time might contextualize mass extinction, but it cannot account for the speaker's experience. Specifically, it cannot account for affect, for her longing, for her ache, and most importantly, for the love she feels toward her son. Why love one's own kind or any other kind in a world destined for destruction? Why linger over desire? And for that matter, why write poetry? I read the poem's closing lines as a response to such questions. Bass rejects nihilism on the grounds that love makes the big picture apprehensible in the first place. Extinction is tragic only as it relates to love. In the absence of love, species loss is interpretable only against the backdrop of planetary history, a framework in which all losses appear equally meaningless. Either we love species and therefore their persistence needs something, or we disavow love in favor of a neutral big picture. Either there is love or, quote, "there never was anything else." For Bass, love is thus a form of interpretation, an act of reading through which geologic time and the prospect of a sixth mass extinction become meaningful. Love and affection seldom surface in academic conversations about extinction where, in general, ugly feelings predominate. Recent work in the environmental humanities examines extinction as it relates to anxiety, mourning, melancholy, and other unpleasant states. Literary critics, for example, question whether traditional genres, such as the elegy, are adequate to the task of confronting a sixth mass extinction. Meanwhile, extinction is increasingly salient to psychologists as a source of psychic distress. Recent studies cite extinction as one of many factors behind ecological grief, an emerging malady of the Anthropocene. Of course, popular discourse about extinction has long revolved around grief, loss, and scarcity. Since its inception, mainstream environmentalism has framed environmental despoliation of all kinds as a departure from baseline conditions. According to this paradigm, anthropogenic changes damage nature's integrity, gradually and irreversibly chipping away at ecosystems. In the early 1980s, Paul and Andy Ehrlich famously imagined Earth as an airplane from which humans are carelessly popping griffins, that is, killing off individual species whose ecosystem function might become clear only in retrospect. This rivet popper hypothesis persists even today in the popular imagination, despite evidence that exposes its limitations. The rest of this talk, I challenge the assumption that only grief, mourning, and melancholy are appropriate responses to a sixth mass extinction. What happens when we reframe extinction in terms of love, affection, and attachment between and among both humans and non-human others? Excuse me, I build on the work of Deborah Bird Rose, Glenn Maxwell, and others who have written on love and extinction, as well as the 2009 novel, How the Dead Dream by Lydia Millett, a text that explores love as it relates to both loneliness and species loss. As Millett's novel illustrates, what we lose with extinction is not only biodiversity, but also opportunities for attachment between humans and animals, and between creatures themselves. What follows extinction is, of course, biological impoverishment, but also an attenuation of affect, a dwindling of intra and interspecies experience. Hence, to linger over love is to insist upon the value of this experience, to resist the zoom out to a disorienting and ultimately paralyzing big picture. The reorientation I propose might seem counterintuitive or even misguided. Why linger over love and affection in the midst of a crisis? Why not instead get down to the cold, hard business of being sad, being mad, and refusing to be placated? As Maxwell observes, love is out of fashion among queer theorists, many of whom have dismissed it as a pernicious force for normativity. Among eco-critics, meanwhile, professing the love of nature is no longer commonplace. If anything, love is associated with the naive, narrative, deeply personal scholarship that prevailed during the field's very early days. Finally, in popular culture, there is perhaps no anti-environmental epithet with more force than tree hugger. Hugging, i.e. loving nature, is for sentimental hippies, fools who, depending upon your political orientation, are either perverse or simply naive. Yet what is possible when we marginalize or ignore love in our discussions about extinction? I argue that love has unique potential to focus attention on the intangible, ineffable losses that accompany extinction. If extinction is a flattening of biodiversity, it is also a flattening of emotional life, a winnowing of opportunities for attachment. E.O. Wilson has characterized the coming era as an age of loneliness, or eremocene, in which humans will survive, yet find ourselves alone on a biologically impoverished planet. If we are to avert an age of loneliness, then we must foreground the role of love and affection as a better alternative. The opposite of loneliness is companionship, an age of camaraderie in which love and a sense of kinship with human and non-human others anchors our ethical deliberations. I want to turn for a moment now to talk about this concept we've been talking about a lot, the Anthropocene. It sounds better when it's mic'd, don't you think? In 2020, it's difficult, if not impossible, to discuss extinction without invoking the Anthropocene, a concept first articulated in 2000 by chemist Paul Crutzen, but now wielded by humanists, social scientists, and journalists alike. According to the dominant Anthropocene narrative, humans have altered the planet so substantially as to tilt it out of the Holocene, which began about 11,000 years ago, and into a new geological epoch. While disagreement persists among stratigraphers about whether there is, or will soon be, a globally synchronous stratigraphic marker for the Anthropocene, other experts assert that the present extinction crisis is sufficient evidence for an age of humans. Indeed, the sixth extinction is commonly cited as the key indicator of an Anthropocene. If the planet's past five mass extinctions events mark enormous ruptures in Earth's history, then it stands to reason that the ongoing mass extinction will appear similarly catastrophic in retrospect. By now, a great many thinkers have explored the scientific and philosophical consequences of conceptualizing humankind as a geological force. Less fully explored are the cultural consequences of what I'm going to call a pop-out Anthropocene, that is a widespread cultural awareness of the present as a unit of geologic time. In Western news publications, one discerns an emerging structure of feeling. Environmental changes, such as extinction, that were once framed in other terms, are now positioned as emblems of the Anthropocene. On the one hand, this shift is a positive development. Journalists are more explicitly linking extreme weather and other developments to anthropogenic climate change. On the other hand, the mainstreaming of deep time may have dubious effects on how people conceptualize human and non-human agency in a time of crisis. How does the extinction framework determine or delimit how it is possible to feel about extinction? A difficulty is that the Anthropocene discourse tends to overlook the richness of our current attachments to species that are still here, at least for now, as well as the creaturely attachments and desires that are unaccounted for by a view from the distant future. What will sea turtles or sun bears or other threatened species have wanted in the Anthropocene? This is not a fanciful question. It is rather an acknowledgement that the practice of species conservation already brings us into contact with agentic assemblages of people, animals, plants, and natural forces. To frame extinction as a binary choice, to save or not to save, in which the anthropos watches a finite array of other species rivets pop one by one off airplane Earth, is to ignore the competing inter- and intra-species interests that inevitably surround conservation. In an article critical of the so-called Edenic sciences of conservation biology, invasion biology, and restoration ecology, cultural geographers Paul Robbins and Sarah A. Moore take these fields to task for disavowing the political nature of their work. These fields, they argue, face an existential crisis in the Anthropocene as novel ecosystems and the rapid pace of environmental change challenge the very notion of a natural system state. Robbins and Moore therefore urge scientists to be, quote, explicitly, honestly, and strategically political, to, quote, enunciate desires while acknowledging those of others. Scientists, they argue, should ask, what are our desires and how are they entangled in the desires of others? To whom does value flow in conservation experiments and at whose expense? Although affect is not Robbins and Moore's focus, nor are the desires of non-human species as opposed to those of scientists and indigenous peoples, their essay nonetheless chimes with the conceptual experiment I'm proposing. Conservation is about desire, ours and presumably that of the creatures that we hope to save. Catherine Sandilands points out, environmentalism has long struggled with desire and with positive emotions more generally. Whereas consumer culture presents us with the promise of limitless abundance, pleasure, and novelty, environmentalism is typically associated with asceticism and self-denial. In order to save nature, we are entreated to sacrifice and simplify. Stacey Lamo observes in Western culture, quote, we are not accustomed to thinking about pleasure as ethical. At the same time, she continues, ascetic practices frequently enforce corporeal boundaries or encourage a denial of or transcendence from nature and place. Thus, Lamo proposes that, quote, pleasurable practices may open up the human self to forms of kinship and interconnection with non-human nature. If, in the realm of environmentalism more generally, appeals to pleasure are more effective than shaming, and mounting evidence suggests that this is indeed true, then perhaps it's time to admit a wider range of affects into extinction discourse. My concern is whether the big picture afforded by geology allows us to try on new affective stances toward extinction. As critics of the term Anthropocene have demonstrated, the dominant Anthropocene narrative reinforces a pernicious nature-culture dualism. In this paradigm, man acts upon nature, thoughtfully pillaging resources while other species passively await certain doom. Scarcity awaits us over the horizon. Our best and perhaps only option is to hoard Earth's dwindling number of animals, plants, and insects and pile them into a lifeboat headed for somewhere. Sarah Enzer contends the rhetoric of saving species and mentions our cultural phobia toward illness, frailty, and death. In the rush to save certain creatures, we fail to develop an ethic for living with terminality, a challenge queer theory began to explore during the 1980s AIDS crisis. For Enzer, queer texts invite us to ask, quote, what possibilities for relation exist amidst terminality, and what similarities may be between a place or planet persisting on borrowed time and a human being or human couple doing the same. In addition, they invite us to imagine terminality as its own temporality, as a space of possibility rather than merely a state of futurelessness. A queering of the Anthropocene might make room for novel affective responses to our self-awareness about geologic time and mass extinction. To return to Ellen Bass's poem, one limitation of Anthropocene discourse is that it frames extinction in a way that is misfitted to human sensing. To borrow a metaphor from cinema, merely invoking the Anthropocene involves zooming out on the present to a vantage point that distorts everyday experience. It becomes difficult in this rendering of history to discern what specifically we are losing as mass extinction unfolds. Bass suggests that in contrast, zooming in on our affective experience has a clarifying effect. Our love for one another makes the stakes of a lonely, biologically impoverished future easier to discern. I want to turn now to talk a little bit about the novel that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk that I think is an interesting exploration of these issues. But even Millett's How the Dead Dream is not ostensibly about extinction, although it certainly figures into Millett's vision, as the novel's acknowledgments include a dedication to the West African black rhinoceros, as well as an alphabetical list honoring, quote, the rarest species in the United States, any of which may vanish in the blink of an eye. So clearly extinction is on Millett's mind when she's writing this. I'm going to give just a real brief little kind of plot summary, because I know not everyone is familiar with the novel, but I'll keep it short, because I'm mindful of time. So How the Dead Dream centers on a character called Thomas, who's called T by the other characters. He's a white, middle-class American man who comes of age in the 1990s and builds a successful property development company. In his youth, T is fascinated by money. As an only child, he spends a lot of his time hatching small-time entrepreneurial schemes. He struggles with social interaction. His peers and his parents' inconsistencies puzzle T, whose hyper-rational approach to success and to reading people hints perhaps at an autism spectrum diagnosis. Eventually, as he grows up, gets older, T moves to Southern California and starts this real estate development company that becomes wildly successful. Although he becomes successful financially, he remains socially isolated. A key turning point in the plot occurs when T hits a coyote on the freeway. In shock, he jumps out of the car and runs to the dying animal. As he sits next to the coyote, he's seized by a fit of radical empathy. He imagines, quote, the shock from the coyote's ruined legs coursing through her body, what must be the blind surge of pain as the end closed in. The narrator's description continues. A loud end, the rush of cars still distant, punctuated by searing noise and glare of those approaching, bearing down viciously and then fading again. She was dying in the smells of asphalt, exhaust, and gasoline, no doubt also the smell of her own blood and him and other smells he could not know himself. The fullness, the terrible sympathy. T wonders if he has ever felt this fullness before. The coyote dies. T feels, quote, relieved but oddly disoriented. Where was the ambulance? No, he was all she had, all her lights, all her rescue workers. It is just a coyote, T reminds himself, and yet he feels confused and unable to leave the scene. The incident introduces several of the novel's themes: animal loneliness, interspecies empathy, and the ethical imperative of witnessing. It's also the beginning of T's journey from a hard-nosed capitalist into someone who realizes belatedly that the market cannot account for the value of biodiversity. T's transformation is gradual. How the Dead Dream is not a conversion narrative in which a burst of epiphany wholly alters the protagonist. Instead, T's revelations about the value of creaturely lives unfold within the context of his social relationships. Learning to navigate different kinds of love and affection with other humans is a process that both supports and is supported by his developing love for non-human others. This is not to say that How the Dead Dream facilely celebrates the healing power of love. Love in the novel is closely connected with grief and loss. T's father comes out as gay and leaves his mother, who later suffers a stroke and after that a long period of cognitive decline. Meanwhile, T falls deeply in love with a woman named Beth who dies suddenly in just a few months into their relationship from a heart condition. Sorry about all the plot spoilers for those who have read the book. Great book to read. Extinction first surfaces about halfway through the novel when a development project T is pursuing threatens to wipe out, quote, a small group of kangaroo rats that are the last of their kind on the brink of disappearing. T brokers a mitigation agreement with the local government in which biologists will relocate the rats to another parcel of land. This plan fails when the rats die at a holding facility. Still distraught over the loss of Beth, T begins spending evenings at the empty mitigation site and then at zoos, where he searches for solace and a sense of companionship amongst endangered animals. T imagines these animals' predicament as similar to his own. This is a quote from the novel. He knew the zoo animals lived in cages, but nothing more about them, except that they were alone. Most of them, not only alone in their cages often, but alone on Earth, vanishing. Their condition was close to what he was trying to grasp, lay somehow at the base of his growing suspicion that the ground was no longer fixed, was shifting beneath him. T realizes that, quote, a loss like his own is common, and that he cannot pretend to the animal's isolation. Still, his feelings for Beth lead him to a kind of interspecies empathy, a, quote, glimpse of something that he finds in losing Beth. And this is also a quote from the novel. If a being could be so singular to another, there is no doubt that there was singularity elsewhere, that the irreplaceable nature of being was not limited to his own small circle. Importantly, T's realization extends beyond intra-human experience. If he and Beth enjoyed one irreplaceable nature of being as lovers, then, he reasons, similar unique worlds must exist between and among non-human creatures. In time, T begins to connect extinction with ecological collapse, as well as novel forms of loss and loneliness associated with the diminution of biodiversity. Among these is the graying of the world, that is, the transformation of animal habitats as human cities expand. T flips through magazines where he sees animals far away, set against backdrops of green, others yellow, others a bright turquoise, white now and then, Siberia or the Antarctic. In contrast, there was the gray of human habitation. The blue parts were turning brown, the yellow places to dust, the green places to smoke and ashes. As the gray metastasizes, species blink out and a quiet mass disappearance ensues. T wonders why this inversion of the arc seems to be, quote, passing unnoticed, except by fringe elements and elite groups, professors and hippies and small populations of little importance. I'll leave you to think on that quote, by the way. Here and elsewhere in the text, Millet Stride describes extinction as something rather like the opposite of what Deborah Bird Rose calls world-making, the process in which, in becoming with others, we bring forth worlds of action and meaning with varied possibilities for life and for death. T feels as though each time one of the animals disappeared, they went by species or sometimes by organizations of species interconnected. It was as though all the mountains were gone or all the lakes, a certain form of the world. As species disappear, possible futures disappear. Besides types of life, Earth loses entire ways of being that both include and exceed the species lost. One might argue that T's personal transformation is too little too late, and indeed, how the dead dreams on an ends on an unresolved note, with T lost and delirious in a jungle near his latest development project. In the novel's final pages, T arrives at, quote, farsightedness. Once in the thrall of capitalism, he realizes that, quote, the market had failed to see the animals for what they were, the animals in their own places with the ancient networks of their culture and landscape intact, worth far more than single commodities. On its own, this revelation might not seem all that profound, especially to readers who are already concerned about the collapse of global ecosystems. More provocative are T's ruminations on a gray future to come, one in which humans survive the Anthropocene only to find themselves desperately lonely. I'm going to quote just a real brief quote of the text here that I think is worth quoting. When all the ones that you loved had died, so it was for the last animals and for him. What did anyone do when they were alone? Angry, a person might thrash and fight, even against himself. Later, you would have to sit, crying, crumple-faced in a pile of the dead. This is how it would be with men after they finish their work. They would have to be alone after that, and for so many years. On and on they would live, surrounded by gray. Complexity would be gone, replaced with dull sameness but stretched out unending. And when they had killed all of their friends and everywhere was empty, only then would they see how terribly they had loved them. In T's vision, humans fail to acknowledge their love for other creatures until we have already killed them off. We discover in retrospect that the tragedy of extinction is not merely about biodiversity, it is also about love and companionship, about infinite modes of interspecies world-making apprehensible only through affect. Implied as a corollary, if we attune to our love for non-human others now, we might avert a mass extinction. Now, just briefly in conclusion, I am not so naive, nor I imagine as Millet, to think that averting the looming extinction crisis could be as simple as just asking people to love the world's creatures. Love is not a policy solution, and in general, the discourse of love is a mixed record when it comes to political movements. Still, I think it's worth asking how love can help us to navigate the moment we're in. Instead of asking what will we lose in the future, what if we were to ask what will we love in the future? What kinds of flourishing multi-species environments will best support the emotional lives we desire? In addition, we might ask how interspecies assemblages already support and enrich our loving human-to-human relationships. Doing so will bring into relief all that we stand to lose if extinction continues at its current rate, all the many feelings and experiences unaccounted for by endangered species lists, aerial photos of the Amazon and placards at the zoo. Timothy Morton notes that although reasons for being nice to other life forms abound, there is, quote, around them a ghostly penumbra of feelings of appreciating them for no reason at all. He continues, just loving something never has a great reason attached to it. If you can list all the reasons why you should love this particular person, you are probably not in love. Perhaps when it comes to extinction, there's something to be said for love's stubborn unjustifiability. Love does not need scientific sanction. It does not require ratification by experts. One can love an animal or a plant or an insect without recourse to its ecological function or to some other external measure of value. In this moment of crisis, love is clearly not all we need. Still, it is a vital addition to our toolkit, for it can help us to envision the possible futures surrounding extinction in terms of abundance and desire, rather than only scarcity, fear, and anxiety. The big picture thrills our brains, but it's the wrong size for our hearts. Thanks.
Pets, cats, dogs, they have we incorporate them in our industrial metabolism, so they pollute. So two large dogs has an ecological footprint equivalent to one person in Bangladesh, because they are incorporated in the industrial metabolism. So how we love without incorporating into our industrial destructive systems would be the question, or also how we love things that we cannot see, like microorganisms and bacteria, which are extremely important for our survival. So it's interesting, but to me these questions come to mind, and I wonder if you have thought about that.
Yeah, well, as someone who has spent a lot of time trying to search for sustainable pet food, and having arrived at the notion that I could buy my cat something made out of venison, because I don't think you can CAFO a deer, although I'm not positive about that. I have thought a lot about this. I mean, this is tricky. I think you're absolutely right. Right, the animals that are in the first world, at least the animals that are closest to a lot of us, are indeed very resource intensive. I mean, I do think there is value to, and I think, you know, even though, as you point out, there are very serious problems with that, there is value to at least kind of calling attention to the ways that our relationships with non-human others kind of open up spaces for possibility to maybe make room for us to love other things, even if we're still working our way towards something where we're not, as you put it, kind of pulling animals into this kind of capitalist system that's really destructive. I mean, I encounter similar kinds of ambivalence, and perhaps some other folks in the room do, about zoos. If you go to the zoo and you see what is happening, a lot of parents are leading little small children around, you know, the thinking behind a lot of the work, I think a lot of zoos do now, is to say, hey, we need to expose young children to these animals so that they learn to love them, right, and they develop some affection for them. And meanwhile, you see the kids are running around with, you know, piles of little plastic gorilla head cloths, you know, cups and other nonsense like that, right, where you're thinking, is this the best way for us to save these species? And yet, you know, I do think that there is some value in promoting that sense of connection, especially from children, right, before we beat them over the head with all of the complexities of things about conservation and about, you know, resources and so on. So maybe that's a very naive thought on my side about that. But I guess thank you for raising those issues, because I do think they are complicated. And maybe by way of finishing up this comment, I will say that I think, especially when it comes to thinking about young people, and for those of us who, you know, most of us in the room teach, I think we need to think seriously about the value of bringing love into the conversation to give our students something to grasp onto that is not quite as harsh and immediately panic-inducing as all the things that we would hope to talk to them about after we talk to them about love. I don't know if that answers your question or... Yeah,
sure. I love the paper. I do want to think sort of about, I do think that affect and rethinking affect is really important, but I do think with love, we're trying to sort of return us to a sort of form of agency which has a tendency to become too anthropocentric.
Right.
Like there was this one formulation, what kinds of flourishing multi-species environments will best support the emotional lives we desire? Right, so there is a tendency to think about what it is that we might desire.
Right.
And in that regard, I was also thinking along the lines of, well, I'm supporting pets, but why am I supporting mosquitoes? Right. So in many ways it would suffocate, as you also point out, right, the same kind of oppression as compassion has as Adam Smith point out of acts of compassion locks us in into specific kinds of bubbles, but has a really hard time becoming politically effective and instituted accordingly. So in that regard, I would want to plead for some kind of institutional love, and rather than sort of this more personal love. Although I'm very much on track that I do think having two young children is really important.
No, I mean,
to be effectively connected, but I also want to have. I'm also very suspicious.
I totally agree, and I mean there are thinkers like the philosopher Benjamin Hale, for example, makes an argument against loving nature in favor of rational compassion as a better framework that doesn't run into quite as many of those kinds of problems, and I certainly agree with that and see room for that. I guess I'm a deeply pragmatic person. I'll go ahead and come out as a pragmatic person here, which is not to say that I do not have other high-flying ideals. I do take bugs in my house and put them on little pieces of paper and move them outside, and so I have nutty tendencies like that. But I mean, I think that when we are in the midst of a crisis, I guess what I'm proposing is love is perhaps some additional concept for us to add into the conversation. It certainly can't be the ending point, but if we're thinking about a world where there are great numbers of people have no care whatsoever at all for non-human others, whether that's microbes or mosquitoes or the things they're going to go eat at lunch today, you know, I think there's room for promoting some kinds of discourses that may not hit our kind of academic ideal, right, of what we would like to see, but might open the conversation a little bit more, especially because we're in such a fractured moment. I know that's a very trite thing to say. I recognize that has been repeated over and over again, but when we're trying to think through how do we get past some of the, especially in our country, incredibly, incredibly fractious political divides, I think we need to make room for ways of some people connecting to environmentalism that are not perfect, right? That might be about being able to leverage a kind of emotional or affective connection, because I think there's also a lot of thinkers that would argue that it's very, very difficult to get people to a truly rational understanding of why we need to do certain things, right? That so many decisions, so many pro-social behaviors that we might engage in are affect-driven. And so I think getting us to that might require that. And so what I'm suggesting is not, like I said, that you know, love is all we need. It's clearly not. I'm merely suggesting that we might toss it into the mix along with some of the other very difficult feelings, right, that are circulating. I don't know about many of you, but when I teach, I think a lot of times it can become incredibly paralyzing to my students to just keep hitting it over and over and over again on these are all the terrible things that are happening without turning to something else. I thought, was there a question back here? Yeah.
Yeah, I had a question and a comment. So talking about love and affect, I'm thinking to non-humans.
Mm-hmm.
The risk of talking about love and affect, and I don't like that. It's like that's one of the reasons I don't like it, because it's one-way relationship. So in order for us to have a relationship with a non-human,
mm-hmm.
we have to have a language between the non-human and the human, right?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore I have to grant agency
mm-hmm.
to the non-human, in this case a non-human animal,
mm-hmm.
in order to have a relationship with me.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about love, then we're, like, as you were saying, like, we're centering again in this anthropocentric relationship, saying, I think what a rhinoceros
mm-hmm.
wants. I think I know what an elephant needs.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the times, non-humans, what they need is for us humans to step back.
Right.
To take action upon that. Like, what I'm saying is that it seems that in an act of love will say, then we have to restrict our agency as humans in,
mm-hmm.
in the non-human realm.
Mm-hmm.
That will be an act of
mm-hmm.
pure love to say, you know what, I think we need to stop doing human things to
right.
the non-humans.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I think love has to have, like, and I think is where all the relationships can be like a close relationship to a human, or it can be like friendship, et cetera, et cetera. Usually what it entails is to have a backbone of that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the case of like a crisis, it requires liberation and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, love becomes paralyzing as well as anxiety,
mm-hmm.
right? Because no other, like, relationships, they don't survive out of love.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Even mm-hmm. if like we want to romanticize a relation, they don't survive mm-hmm. any relationship.
Mm-hmm.
They have to have some sort of work, and they have to be out of freedom.
Right.
And that's the same with heterosexuality, like forced heterosexuality and heteronormativity.
Mm-hmm.
If it's being forced,
mm-hmm.
if it's being within a patriarchal relationship,
mm-hmm.
then it's going to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
If it's founded within the colonization of gender and the colonization of patriarchy and the colonization of the non-human realm and the human-human
mm-hmm.
human and non-human relationships,
mm-hmm.
then it becomes freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I am thinking and what I am aiming is that we all like to be free. I mean, not in that kind of like an Adam Smith type of liberal market freedom, right? But we want freedom.
Right.
And we like you know, like in American way, it's like, oh, we want freedom of market, right? But what we want to see is freedom and justice. That's where I want to go. So what we have to theorize, like how law and justice they can come together and what will entail.
Yeah, no, I heartily agree with. I'm sorry, I saw a hand flail over here. No, okay.
I'll wait.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's a much broader conversation to be having here about the politics of love, which is many people have written on this, and there's kind of parts of, if I were going to develop this argument, I would certainly delve into that in a lot more depth, because there are a lot of different kinds of theorists, right, coming from many different realms, including queer theory, that have kind of thoroughly critiqued many different things about love and kind of dyadic attachments and the ways that love can be a really serious problem. I mean, I think that for me, in thinking about extinction, and particularly the ways that I talk to young people about it, it is helpful for calling our attention to sort of that endpoint of what we're looking for. People are going to make it, right? We're not. I mean, I know a lot of times we have this. We tend to talk about the Anthropocene as though people are going to become extinct, and perhaps that will be true, but probably not, right? Probably people will persist in some form for a very, 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 very long time. We're a very canny species that's done a great job of doing that. And so I think kind of trying to look ahead to that. What's the point of us surviving, right, the Anthropocene, if there's not something more there besides mere life, right, besides just sheer persistence and survival? I think for the average person, again, for the person who's in the kind of baby steps of their kind of emerging understanding of why they might care about the environment at all, despite all of the problems that you mentioned that are incredibly true about love, you know, thinking about love can actually direct our attention a little bit outward, right? Just beyond the scenario of the action movie where the world is ending, but there's a small band of survivors who happen to, led by someone with very large muscles, right, happen to make it, right? And they survive despite all of these other things. The movie always ends there, right? The movie does not continue with, good news, the 12 of you made it, now what? Right? Now you live on a burnt out, you know, impoverished shell of a planet where there's still zombies switching in the corner or whatever the scenario is, right? And I think that trying to refocus to think about what are the kinds of attachments that we feel like we do want to have to you know, non-human others, and not only just to non-human others, but I mean, I think it's important for us to remember that non-human others can be involved in forms of attachment between and among people as well. Again, to go back to the pets example, I know that pets are incredibly imperfect in a lot of ways in this scenario, but you know, pets do open up spaces of affection and attachment between and amongst people. How many of you have ever had a situation where you've never talked to your neighbors until there's a missing dog, and all of a sudden everybody comes out into the street, right? And people that never had any sort of sense of community before are all suddenly banded together around the idea of what are we going to try to do to help this dog, or even a wild animal, right? I've had this happen with an injured animal in my front yard before. And maybe that's a silly example because that's very trivial, but you know, I do think it's worth considering that there are ways that attachment can, I think, do something other than just kind of focus us inward to that, you know, family stickers people keep on the back of their minivans. Well, family sticker tribe. You guys are looking at me like a nuts. Maybe this is a Midwestern thing? No? That the that we live in a world where I think that is kind of the locus of a lot of our attention as far as affection goes, and there might be ways of looking outward. So I 100% agree with and appreciate everything you're saying. I think I might just be more pessimistic about the about our ability to get to that liberatory moment of kind of true justice and thinking about what that would mean without some other kind of intermediate steps. That makes sense. Yeah.
Maybe we need to stop and move on. So yes, thank you.
We can continue the conversation anyway.